Mike Tate of Milwaukee has been chairman of the Wisconsin Democratic Party since 2009, and that's until Saturday, June the 6th, when he's decided to no longer seek re-election, and there'll be a new chairman elected at the party convention in Milwaukee.
Yep.
Mike, thanks for talking to Wisconsin Eye.
Happy to be here.
What an amazing run of political history you have witnessed, right?
Yeah, it's may you live in interesting times, and it certainly has been. You know, there's been times of trial and triumph and, you know, difficulty, and it's been an amazing time to be party chair. Obviously, you know, not everything went our way by any means, but it's been an amazing experience.
Let's talk about the biggest changes, and can we start within the wake of Citizens United?
Yeah.
Let's talk about money.
Well, and just, yeah, I was thinking about this, just since 2009 when I got elected, the amount of money that the party needs to raise just to stay competitive. And, you know, you see some people, oh, we shouldn't focus so much on money. I think that people don't understand, you know, to just to keep field offices open, to put staff on the ground is, you know, millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, I think the party raised around $7 million last year. We're going to end up around $45 million for the 6 years I've been chair, which is a, you know, astronomical record that, you know, is exponentially bigger than what anyone else has done before. And it's not enough, Steve, because we're competing against these super PACs and these shadowy organizations that, you know, need one billionaire or one multi-multi-millionaire to bankroll them. And, you know, they can wipe out the, you know, 100,000 individual donors the party has given $5, $10 at a time. That's the biggest change from a structural perspective of, you know, just money and the amount of time you spend on fundraising. I mean, I think if you look at the budget for what's likely to be next year, the party chair next year is going to have to raise for 365 days an average of about $20,000 a day.
$20,000 a day. Dialing for dollars, $20,000.
365 days a year.
My
and that's
goodness.
And obviously it doesn't work that way because you don't raise a lot of money in December. So it's tremendous.
With the advent of billionaires and very rich coming in and funding their own candidates, how greatly has it diminished the role of both parties, not only yours but the GOP as well?
Well, I think that nationally, it has been a big problem. I will say that I believe in Wisconsin, both the state Republican Party and the state Democratic Party have actually been able to have a clear niche, and that's because we've been good at raising money. Mm-hmm. We've been good at being visible and effective, and I think that one of the reasons you're seeing a competitive race to replace me is because we've seen the party become a much more important player and a much louder voice in the political process than it has previously.
Yeah, you're talking about the five-way race to replace you.
Yes.
We will talk about that in a minute.
Sure.
What are you proudest of in your tenure as chair?
You know, obviously, I think anytime I turn on C-SPAN and see Tammy Baldwin in the well of the Senate, that's something that I think people all too often forget how much she was the underdog. You know, how much she was this, you know, liberal woman from Madison taking on the great Tommy Thompson. And to see that victory was really impressive. To carry the state for the president as well was huge. But to be honest with you, I really think that it's almost, you know, sort of smaller things. You know, the recall movement, which, you know, has been much decried in retrospect, was, I think, Bob Jouk, I think, said it best. It was the day that it was passed, the Act 10 was debated in committee, the Capitol's starting to fill with people. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. He grabs a bullhorn. And this is one of the great moments that will live on YouTube for forever. And he said, I believe this is what we're witnessing is the rebirth of the progressive movement in Wisconsin. Now, we didn't win right away, and some would argue, as I would, we still haven't gotten there. But I believe that the movement that was started there is what's going to be why we will achieve, you know, significant victories in the near future. The other thing I'd point to is 3 years ago, we had our state convention scheduled 3 days after we lost the gubernatorial recall election. Mm-hmm. I, among many, was kind of nervous about what are we going to see here. It's in Appleton. 1,500 people showed up. And in the face of what was a tough defeat for a lot of people, a personal, emotional thing that people had become so invested in, we were able to take that energy and instead of despair, turn it into enthusiasm and vigor. And we went on to, just a few months later, elect Tammy Baldwin, carry the state for the president, and have some great victories. So there's a couple of moments that stand out.
Let's talk about the recall for a minute. There has been some criticism that the party got involved late in that recall. Can you respond to that? Would you, in hindsight, have played the recall differently, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I don't know how I would have done that. You know, I think that we were involved in the recall election at the appropriate time. There was a period of time when it was appropriate, so a citizen-led movement. We never tried to supplant that. I think that its strength was it was a citizen-led movement, and in many ways it was a leaderless movement up until the point that we had to transition into, okay, now we need to elect a candidate. And that was where, you know, we just had difficulty as a movement, as a party, as a state, taking what was all this energy around the anger and just the belief that Scott Walker hadn't told the truth during the campaign and that he was taking actions that were harmful to Wisconsin, and translate that into a candidate campaign. We weren't able to do that. Now, obviously, I think that the hindsight is we didn't lose that recall election because of something we did wrong. It was because a lot of voters, including a lot of Democrats, just felt that the governor hadn't broken the law and he didn't deserve to be recalled.
Yeah, there were more votes cast, 2.5 million in the recall, than in the 2010 election for governor. Scott Walker, why can't your party beat him?
Well, listen, I think that the two most important variables in politics are talent and luck. He's had both in tremendous measure. I think that he is someone who is easily underestimated, and that's a mistake that people have made over and over again. But what he's been able to do is create this sort of veneer of authenticity and this belief that in an era when voters crave politicians who will take a stand and do something, he's been able to convert what I think are very bad policy choices into getting credit for, well, he did something. I may not agree with it, I may not understand it, I may not think it's the right thing, but he did something. And that counts for a lot. I think it's awful helpful, and listen, I don't say this about many, if any, other Republicans. One of the things in this job is I've actually gotten to know some Republicans who have, while I disagree with them, I've come to like them a lot. But I think that Scott Walker has no moral center. I don't think he has a moral compass that guides him. I think that someone like Paul Ryan, who has a moral compass, it may point the direct opposite direction that mine does, but I think that he gets up every day and believes in what he's doing is the right thing. Scott Walker, in a business full of people that are fueled by ambition and ego, has been running for president for the last 20 years. And his blows with the wind is extremely malleable. He has no sort of center core and convictions other than himself getting ahead. And that makes it a little bit easier when you can sort of twist with the breeze.
You've been a very outspoken, a very high-profile chairman, and which means you have your opponents. And your opponents say it's your fault that you haven't beaten Scott Walker and there's only 36 Assembly Democrats and only 14 Senate Democrats. Can you respond to those critics?
Well, you know, look, we got caught up in two huge wave elections in 2010 and 2014, and I would be willing to shoulder, to personally volunteer to shoulder all the blame personally if there weren't 38 other states that got their clocks cleaned in the Democratic Party this last time around. But I think the larger point there is, what does the party chair end up doing? Mm-hmm. When you win an election, you know, victory has a thousand parents, and the state party's not one of them, by design. We don't take victory laps and we don't take curtain calls as party chairs. Now, when you lose, defeat's an orphan. And any one of those five candidates running that has any question of who the orphan is, if they lose, should go look in the mirror, because that's who the orphan is. That's the job. And I was very aware of that coming into it. I knew that there would be good days and bad days, but I've loved every day of this job because of the challenges. People want to blame me. That's fine. It doesn't bother me. It's not my fault. It's not any individual's fault. It was a tough election. People did the best job they could. We had great candidates. You know, could there have been minor changes along the way? Sure. Would it have affected the outcome? I really don't believe so.
Biggest thing left undone in your tenure, the fact that Scott Walker went 3-0?
Well, obviously that's sort of the thing that I think is a pretty glaring, you know, result of what happened is, I mean, you know, I think that that's obviously a huge disappointment. And it's something that, you know, I've wrestled with a lot, and I really believe that the state party is in many ways stronger today than it was 6 years ago as an entity organizationally. I think that we are incredibly primed to win Russ Feingold, you know, have Russ Feingold defeat Ron Johnson, carry the state for the presidential nominee next year. And we're going to set the stage to take back the governor's office in 2018 and take back the legislature. But yeah, I mean, it's been no fun losing to Scott Walker. But at the same time, Steve, I don't think that any decisions that I had control over that I made, if I'd made them differently, would have changed the outcome. And I don't think there's anyone either running for chair right now or had there been a different person's position that would have ended up with a different result.
Having watched Scott Walker for a number of years, what's your reaction now when he is doing so well in the national polls and is ranked in the top five as a potential GOP presidential nominee, Mr. Chairman?
Not the least bit surprised.
You're not?
No. And, you know, what I get a kick out of is sort of anecdotally, I run into people that voted for Walker three times, and they're like, oh, he's just not serious as a presidential candidate. It's like, what on earth makes you think that? You know, this is a guy that has been underestimated his whole life. I mean, this is a college dropout who has had, you know, had any sort of, you know, number of questionable activities come across his desk. He's been able to dodge any number of corruption activities. This is a guy who, as we all know in that infamous Koch phone call, thought he was talking to David Koch and talked about how they'd actively discussed placing violent protesters in a peaceful crowd. For most politicians, that'd be kind of a death knell. He just sort of suits up and goes out and does a press conference and is able to deflect it. And I think that it's talent and it's skill not used for good, but it's definitely a factor. And listen, I think that you've got this, you know, 19-person clown car of a Republican presidential nominating process.
Yeah, the 8th one got in today. Yeah,
George
Santorum yesterday, Pataki today.
And I think Pataki was like governor of New York when I was in middle school or something like that. You know, you were a little bit younger than you are today.
Thank you.
And, you know, but I'm not surprised that, you know, governor, and I think he'll, anyone who says they know what's going to happen or can actually predict it, it's way too early.
Do you think he'll be the nominee?
I think there's a chance.
Really?
Absolutely.
Well, now let's switch to the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in primaries, and especially, is it good that Hillary Clinton is being challenged by Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley?
I absolutely believe in primaries. I think that if you have serious, credible candidates running, that it helps articulate a conversation within the party. You know, I've taken some knocks over the years because people think, oh, you know, the state party under Mike Tate, you know, engineered, you know, to not have any primaries, and that's just simply not true. I don't know how I would do that. But I think with respect to the presidential contest, obviously there's a reason Hillary Clinton is such a strong frontrunner. It's because she's got the leadership, the talent, the reputation, and the toughness to be the next president of the United States. I've gotten to know Governor Martin O'Malley a little bit. I really like him. I think he's, you know, phenomenal candidate. I think Senator Sanders brings an incredibly important voice to the process and to this election. And I think it's good that we're going to have a primary.
Have you endorsed Hillary?
I have not endorsed any of the candidates.
Okay. Look at the changes that Governor Walker and the GOP leaders in the Senate and the Assembly have passed over the last 5 years.
Right.
Which do you consider the most damaging?
I think there's two things, one specific and one just sort of a general ethos, which is I think we've seen the legalization of corruption in our process. And you see all the problems that Wiedek has had. You see this, you know, ridiculous gerrymandering. I mean, people, you know, forget that during Act 10, they almost sort of blatantly violated the open records law, and then the Supreme Court, controlled by conservative interests, said, oh, it might not have applied there, so don't worry about it. I think we've really seen a corrupting of the process that is bad, but I can just tell you, as a father and as a lifelong Wisconsinite, what they've done to education in this state, what they continue to do. Just yesterday, they slipped something into the budget. Apparently, they would have Wisconsin have the lowest standard for teachers in the K-12 system in the nation. I don't understand why this is a partisan issue, Steve. This is something that having a good K-12 system, having a great university system, something that attracts businesses to Wisconsin, it helps teach and create and retain young people to stay here, to live here, to have families here. And why we'd weaken what was has always been one of the best public university systems in the country, which has been a great K-12 education system in this nation, is simply beyond me. And I think that's the biggest single issue that concerns me.
Yeah, I saw a press release from DPI Superintendent Tony Evers just on that very subject, and he said we would have some of the lowest standards. Let me ask you this, Mike. With all the changes passed by the Republicans the last 5 years, when do you think the pendulum is going to swing back to your party side, and what will it take?
Absolutely it will. I mean, to think that it won't ignores, you know, both history and logic. You know, the pendulum does swing, and I think that we've seen this nationwide since the 2010 election, where a lot of states have become under very red conservative control. I think that we're starting to see an overreach. Obviously, a lot of control has been helped by this influx of money, by us losing in a redistricting year. But it's going to swing back. Now, I can tell you specifically here in Wisconsin, it's going to for a couple of reasons. One, I think you have this record the Republicans have, which is starting to really, I think, weigh on the minds of voters. We do have challenges with redistricting. I mean, I know that, as you know, Steve, historically, you know, there's been Democrats that would get elected to the legislature that outran the top of the ticket. We had, I think, 20-some Democrats running for the legislature get more votes than Mary Burke in the race, but still lost.
People like Mandy Wright in Wausau.
Yeah, right, exactly. But still lost because of how the lines have been changed. But, you know, I really think that the movement that we've seen, you know, listen, we've had 7,000 new people join the party in the last 6 years, 7,000 new members. Membership is at a, you know, decades-long high. Activism is at a decades-long high. We have a five-way race for a reason. It's because there's so many people that are involved and engaged in the process. And I think all that involvement and that engagement and that enthusiasm is the real reason that we're going to have the ground troops and the muscle and the ability to go out there all over the state and take the state back.
I want you, since you're the outgoing chairman, maybe you can answer this question. List some potential Democrats who should consider running for governor in 2018.
Well, I think that there's any number of good people out there. I think you have county executives like Joe Parisi and Thomas Nelson. I think Jen Schilling would be an outstanding candidate for governor.
Have you told her that?
I have.
Okay.
And she generally sort of either leaves the room or avoids the question or moves on to some other part of Senate business that she's working on.
Yes, goes back to her Senate agenda.
Okay. Yeah, and listen, she's been doing a phenomenal job as the Senate leader, and it's been really great to see her there. And I also think that, you know, there are other good candidates, good potential candidates out there, and I fully expect we're going to field a great nominee in 2018.
Ron Kind?
Ron Kind would be a great statewide candidate.
I want to quote from May 17th, New York Times, and I showed you this quote in advance. Mm-hmm. As to how Democrats should be responding to their poor showing below the executive branch, there are two competing schools of thought. Moderates believe the only remedy is for Democrats to refashion themselves as pragmatists who care more about achieving results than ideological purity. Progressives, on the other hand, believe that the Democrats lost their way by obsessing over what President Clinton once termed the vital center. Is that a fair summary of the internal debate in your party between the progressives and there's a purity that they insist on, and the moderates, maybe like the gentleman running for the U.S. Senate in Maryland,
Chris Van Hollen.
Chris Van Hollen, thank you.
Well, listen, I think that neither of those is 100% right. I don't think it's a black or white thing. I think what's incredibly important for Democrats to do is to get out there in their campaigns and talk about what they're for and draw distinctions and differences between their opponent. We're never going to win being a party that's going to cut taxes, but just slightly less so than the Republicans. We're not going to be a party that, you know, deregulates things, but only slightly less so than the Republicans. Voters want authenticity. They crave it. And they're willing to support someone, even if they maybe don't 100% agree with them, if they really believe that this person has the right intentions, is on their side, and is, you know, going to say what they do and do what they say. It's been Russ Feingold's winning formula for any number of years, minus that Republican wave in 2010. It's why I think that he's going to win election to the Senate in 2016. I think that it's not progressive versus centrist. You know, we've got great progressive champions. We've got centrist Democrats, you know, people like Kathleen Vinehout in the West who take much more conservative positions on a number of issues. But we've got, you know, I really think the need to define what we're for, what we stand for, what our issues are, and what are the differences between us and the other side.
U.S. House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi in the same article said this in 2014 elections. Voters, she said, this quoting Pelosi, know that the Republicans are awful. Our people didn't just turn out. Is that what? Do you have a turnout problem?
Not here.
Okay.
That's, I think, you know, there's been some people who I think have some naivete or just lack of understanding of the dynamics of what happened last year in Wisconsin. I think we had the highest or the second highest turnout in the country. We didn't lose the governor's race because turnout wasn't high enough. Now, was it as high as the presidential year? No, of course not. It never is. We saw turnout in, you know, the Milwaukee and Dane counties exceed previous levels of turnout in gubernatorial elections. The reason we didn't win is because we were just unable to go into the Green Bay market, the Wausau market, and La Crosse-Eau Claire market, although we did actually have some comeback in La Crosse-Eau Claire market. So if you look particularly at Green Bay and Wausau, you know, we don't need to win in those markets running statewide, but we need to go get 45-46% of the vote. Tammy Baldwin got 48% of the vote there. We were unable to do that. We didn't even break 40% in the Green Bay market this last time around. And that, to me, the key to winning statewide has always been run up the score in the Milwaukee and Dane County area, mm-hmm. and then you just have to go, you know, in sort of hand-to-hand combat, go get votes in the Green Bay market and the Wausau market, and, you know, get 50-51% of the vote in La Crosse-Eau Claire. We were just unable to do that. It wasn't for lack of trying. You know, in the beginning of 2013, I, for the first time the party ever, put open field offices over a year and a half before the election. We put them in, you know, those outstate areas for a reason. But we have work to do there. There are an awful lot of people, and this is what why I think we lost the governor's race. It wasn't turnout. There are people who voted for Barack Obama and Tammy Baldwin that came out in 2014 and voted for Scott Walker. I've listened to these people in focus groups. And I think is the one thing about it, Leader Pelosi said that's true, is these people even said in these groups, we don't necessarily think that the Republicans are more for us. They had a lack of understanding of what our candidates stood for.
Well, then party growth, best options, right off the suburbs, focus on these areas that you just outlined, the Fox Valley, Green mm-hmm. Bay, Wausau, La Crosse, plus the rural areas. Talk to me about the rural areas. Because you've had some losses in rural Wisconsin, haven't you?
I'm aware of that, yes.
Why?
Well, I think that, again, it has been the difficulty of Scott Walker being an incredibly popular figure in those parts of the state, you know, the Green Bay market, Wausau, La Crosse-Eau Claire, and our inability to have candidates that had a message that could cut through what was an awful loud noise coming from the Republican side. You had national dynamics that I think should never be dismissed. It's not an excuse as much as it's reality. And we just simply were unable to break through. Now, that doesn't mean we can't break through. That doesn't mean that all is lost. You know, I remember, and you can actually go back, you may have covered this as a reporter, when Tommy Thompson, when he was running, would go down to Milwaukee County. He actually won Milwaukee County.
He did.
Running for governor one time. And right. You can go back and read these articles of Democrats throwing up their hands and saying, oh, my God, we're never going to win another statewide election in off year. Tommy Thompson's taken away our base. And you can hear people today say that, oh, we just don't know how to compete in rural Wisconsin. That's not true. The way you compete is by competing and by learning the lessons that you can from past losses, but by getting out there, articulating what you're for, going door to door in legislative contests, and running a good race. And it involves putting together a lot of money. It involves putting together a good campaign. But I have every reason to believe that we are going to turn around what has been some tough losses for us in these more rural areas. But we're not going to do it by saying that, oh, we have a, you know, rural problem, or we have an urban problem. As a party, we need to be unified and view these as challenges that we face as one state.
Explain to me the process that puts your party at the table after, when the next legislative and congressional boundaries are drawn after the 2020 census. Mm-hmm. Explain to me what you need to do in the elections of 2016, 18, and 20 to mm-hmm. at least be at the table when the next lines are drawn.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that there are a couple key things. One, we have three Supreme Court races in the next 3 years. And we obviously have got to, you know, obviously Justice Ann Walsh Bradley just got reelected, which is great news. But we need to make sure that we have a better formula to win these state Supreme Court races, because we've seen the right wing just absolutely wield control of the court by these court seats. And we've got to focus on that. And I don't think anyone can forget how important that is. You know, voter participation in April elections is key. There should be no excuse for citizens who care about democracy to not vote in an April election. There's no excuse for it whatsoever. I think that we need to then, there is a path back to majority of both the Assembly and the Senate. We need to systematically, in a very disciplined fashion, focus on those seats that we can win. And then obviously winning the 2018 governor's race is the easiest way to have a seat at the table for districting. But let me be really clear. I think that there is a very real path. This isn't pie-in-the-sky idealism. This isn't, you know, cheerleader, you-rah-rah, to take back the Senate and the Assembly, if not, you know, one or the other or both, and win the governor's race, so that coming into 2020, we have the ability to not draw partisan lines, but draw fair lines. I can tell you one thing, you know, no zealot like a convert, and I can tell you that I think that one of the biggest things we should do is have redistricting reform that takes it out of the hand of partisan elected officials and puts it into some sort of independent panel. I think Iowa does something like this. I just think that that is incredibly important. We need competitive elections.
Was it a mistake then for your party when you controlled the state house, the legislative and executive branches in the 9-10 session to not pursue the Iowa model of reapportionment?
It was a mistake for us not to do redistricting then.
It was.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk about the convention. You have five candidates running.
Mm-hmm.
That intrigues me. They're different regions, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, Verona, and two from western Wisconsin. Why has the campaign, because it's turned into that, become attracted five candidates and become so emotional?
I have the benefit of not being on the ballot. So I can sort of take the long view on this. We had over 2,300 people sign up on the first cut through to be delegates. We've seen
more than you. I understand you've got more that want to be delegates from Milwaukee and Dane County than actually allotted, correct?
Correct, which is not unusual in smaller counties, but in counties like Milwaukee and Dane, which have, I think, close to 400 delegate spots, that's really something. I mean, I've talked to people that, go back 30, 40 years, they can't remember that ever happening. This is great news, and it's a sign of how much the party's grown. It's a sign of how much enthusiasm there is. It's a sign of how much excitement and emotion there is around, winning back Wisconsin. And regardless of who comes out of it, I think the most important characteristic for members and delegates that are coming to this convention is to pick someone that they believe can unify the state. It has been an emotionally heated battle. There's been a few things that I think have been out of bounds.
Talk to me. At one time, you had to do a Facebook post saying, time out, everybody.
Yeah.
Stop assassinating the character
right.
of the five candidates running for state Dem chair.
Yeah.
Why did
I also did point out that, the consolation prize for the four people who lose is that they get to not be party chair. I did that just because, I've worked very hard to be a fair and neutral arbiter in this process. I haven't endorsed anyone. I'm not endorsing anyone. There's days when I have issues with all five of the candidates, often at the same time. But what we really have is five people running. There has been emotion. I think there's been a few things that have been out of bounds. The two things I think in particular are, I think it's wrong to attack someone's employer when they didn't have anything to do with somebody that at the company, like for example, I don't think Martha Lanning working for Target disqualifies her from being chair. I don't think Jason Ray working for a company that knew somebody that worked for Republicans in another state disqualifies him from being chair given his tremendous record of accomplishment and leadership in the party. I think those two things are really out of bounds. The other thing that frustrates me, and part of this is it's either ignorance or sort of willfully trying to create fear among delegates, is to question the election process. These are rules that weren't put in place by myself, weren't put in place by party leaders. They're put in place by the members.
Okay.
And we have an incredibly fair and transparent process. There's some candidates that are trying to cast doubt on the legitimacy of that. I think that's wrong and not the sign of leadership.
Well, let's talk about the rules on Saturday, June 6th. My understanding is there's going to be one ballot. Mm-hmm. First of all five candidates get a chance to talk in the morning. Then there's going to be one ballot, and the winner is the next chair, correct? There's
that's
no
correct.
Runoffs like there are when caucuses elect leaders in the Capitol?
No, there's no runoffs. It's like, outside of something like a caucus, it's like every other election you have in Wisconsin. Whoever gets the most votes wins. That's how the party constitution is set up. I also think from a practical perspective, a runoff is not a good idea because the election is the last thing that happens at convention. A lot of people cast their vote and leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it would be a very difficult change to make, and it's not something that's possible to change for this convention anyway.
Are you afraid if the next chairman is elected with only 37-38% of the vote, that would cause a split?
Well, that's why I think it's important for the delegates when they make a decision about who to support the candidate that they believe will be able to best unify the party, someone who's not going to hold grudges, someone who hasn't run on dividing Milwaukee and Madison from the rest of the state, someone who's got experience organizing in, urban areas and rural areas, and that can really bring people together.
I talked to a Democratic lawmaker yesterday, and this legislator said, I hear ballots are going to be numbered.
Mm-hmm.
And this lawmaker is afraid that could lead to somebody eventually tracking down who voted for who and retribution. Mm-hmm. Are ballots numbered?
We have to follow the rules laid out by the Democratic National Committee. The top two leaders for our party are superdelegates. They're DNC members, which is something, as you know, codified in law that they can they have a vote in who the nominee for the party is, national party. The party rules dictate that all elections must be held in an open and transparent manner, that there is no mechanism for secret ballot. We're actually one of the few state parties left that elects their party chair through general membership. Most states do it through an administrative committee, a board of directors, et cetera. There's a lot of good arguments for why that is a more representative way to do it, because you get a good balance of people from all over the state and a good balance of people with different levels of experience in the party. But yeah, you know, we have the process that is the closest thing to a full secret ballot in the country. The DNC every year sort of gets pretty nervous about how we do it because they think it doesn't meet their standards of having an open ballot. Every ballot is numbered, so my ballot can be traced back to a sheet.
Do I have to sign for a ballot if I'm a delegate?
Yes, you do.
I do. Okay.
Actually, I don't know if you have to sign for it or not, but you get a, you know.
It's noted that I got ballot number 783.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, and it's never happened, and this is my 17th convention, believe it or not, never happened in my memory, but any member can, within 10 days of the election, file a formal request with the party's administrative committee to see the ballots. Doesn't happen. To whatever lawmaker you talk to, I don't know what type of retribution they think the state party has the power to enact. I can't see any candidate doing anything like that or even what they would exercise retribution on.
Okay. Well, we're almost out of time. You're ending one career. What's your next career? Do you plan to run for office? You've learned a lot about that process.
You know, I don't have any plan on running for office at this time. I can tell you that what I intend to do is to keep helping good people that want to run for office, to keep helping good causes that I care about. I've had a lot of really interesting opportunities to come my way, and I'm going to stay involved.
Final question. Why are you a Democrat, Mike Tate?
Why am I a Democrat?
Yes.
I'm a Democrat because, you know, it is a Democratic Party that stands up for families that are trying to, you know, get ahead and succeed in this state and country. We believe in education. We believe in valuing work. We believe in dignity. And we believe in freedom and opportunity. And the challenges we face, whether income inequality, whether anything else, can be fixed by the policies and beliefs of the Democratic Party.
Mike Tate, Democratic Party chairman, at least until Saturday,
June 6th.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to Wisconsin Eye.